Well, thank you all for coming, and a particular thank you, Louise, for coming. I've really been looking forward to this. I'm not going to do a sort of this is your life here and tell you about your when you were born, where you were born. Insofar as we want that biographical information, it might come out in fact, my first question. It was in this very school that Green had the situation, the experiences that formed him into a writer. And in A Sort of Life, he described his reading and his childhood, which formed him into a writer. In your case, where did it all begin?
I think that for any writer, it always begins in childhood and adolescence. Obviously, Green suffered very badly from depression in his adolescence. I think most writers do. I think if there's one thing that all writers have in common, it's that in certain situations, or in fact a lot of situations, they feel like outsiders. And I think that sometimes the thing that makes them an outsider is very obvious. Either they're living somewhere where they're unhappy, or they're in a family where they're unhappy. Quite often it's something quite subtle. But the thing about outsiders is they become observers. They're the people who sit on the edges of a room looking at everybody else and working out how they will survive within that social situation. And in my case, I grew up in a very small town in the East Midlands. A sort of, if you imagine a kind of smaller, much less glamorous version of Berkhamsted, but a kind of a small country town. And we lived in a sort of brand new 1960s housing estate in a sort of rather horrible modern bungalow on the edge of town with just waste ground outside. And I can distinctly remember lying to my parents as a primary school age child, pretending that I was going to play with the other children from the housing estate and sneaking out of the house with a novel in the pocket of my anorak and building myself a kind of den in this waste ground with sort of ferns and branches and hiding in there. Usually C.S. Lewis, I was a big believer in the world of Narnia, spent a bit of time hiding in wardrobes, which is rather sad. And I think that writers, by and large, they're rarely the popular child at school. And they're people who live their own interior lives quite early on. They're people who have to use their imaginations and have imaginary friends, probably because they don't have that many real ones. So I think that however old you are when you start to write, you might be 87 when you start writing, but I think the roots of that imaginative life probably happened in your childhood.
And so you read a lot as a child. Did you write more than was required at school?
I did. This is kind of confession corner here. I wrote my first novel when I was 11. And in the 1970s, the big children's hit of the era, which I'm sure many of you remember, was Watership Down. Remember Watership Down? I always really liked the standing joke about Watership Down. You've read the novel, you've seen the film, now taste the stew. Talking animals were really, really big in that era. So I wrote a novel about a group of talking horses running across the plains of the Midwest of America, which for a child who had never sat on a horse, was terrified of animals, and had never left the East Midlands, was a really odd choice. But it was a pastiche of Watership Down, probably also influenced by the John Wayne movies that my father used to watch on television every Saturday and Sunday. So it was called Billy Mustang. The horses talked to each other. I believe that for some reason, best known to my younger self, they also wore hats. So they talked to each other, they did hats. And I remember distinctly, I did the illustrations myself, and I decided I wanted it to be a hardback, so I cut out the back of cereal packets and put hard covers on it. Sad, really, isn't it? Look back on it. So that was my
manuscript.
I have got it somewhere buried in a box. I've got Billy Mustang somewhere. And actually, I'm currently, because a university archive is after my papers at the moment, I'm currently in the process of digging a lot of boxes out of the attic, and somewhere in there the talking horses will be. And it remains to be seen what I do when I uncover them, whether I preserve them or burn them in the garden. that was me. There was some wincing there.
Yes, well, some of Green's work that wasn't published at the time was published later. Anthony Sant, his first novel, didn't get a publisher.
I also have a couple of those novels, yeah.
Yes.
I think the novels that I wrote in my 20s that went unpublished, they are destined for the bonfire. I could be blackmailed with those manuscripts. They're really, really bad. I'll never be invited here again if they see the light of day.
So you understand why they were rejected. How did you keep
They were terrible, them? Yes. They were really dreadful. Yeah.
So were they learning experiences?
They were. I mean, I'm a great believer in the fact that every writer has a certain amount of bad prose that they have to kind of get out of their system before they can write anything decent. And I was certainly one of those. I wrote two complete novels before the one that was published, Crazy Paving, the first novel, was actually the third novel that I'd written. And other than that, there were lots of false start short stories. There's vast, vast amounts of drivel there in those boxes.
Were you, like Green, affected by too much admiration for another writer? He so admired Joseph Conrad that his second and third novels were almost imitation Conrad novels, and they failed, and he knew he had to start again, as it were, and perhaps rediscover his own voice, because the first novel had a distinct voice.
Yes, I haven't had that problem, but then I don't think there is one particular writer who I would consider myself to be in the mould of, if you like. I mean, I love Green. I mean, I also love Margaret Atwood and Toni Morrison. So I think that's not been a particular issue for me. I mean, it's obviously it's an issue when your books come to be marketed, but that's a separate consideration.
There does seem to be a wish always to categorise a writer. So for Green, it was the Catholic writer. And he objected to that term and said he's a writer who happens to be a Catholic. Now, with some of your earlier novels, because they had, they were from a woman's point of view, it's a terrible term, chick lit.
Oh, yeah.
That was even though they had serious themes.
They had, I mean, you know, Crazy Paving was about urban terrorism and chaos theory, but because it was populated by young women, you know, and the ghastly covers I got with sort of soft focus women with their heads cut off, and it was a really dreadful time in our literary culture, and I would like to find out whoever invented the term chick lit and stick a bead up their nose, because it was terribly damaging, particularly for young women writers. I mean, I was lucky to escape the worst excesses of being characterised in that way, but I have women writers' friends who wrote very serious books about marriages or relationships, and they'd be published with pink stilettos on the cover. And it was a very, very odd stage, I think. And obviously it was the success of Bridget Jones and that whole genre. Publishers are by nature conservative. They have the bottom line to consider, and books will be marketed in the same way as the last thing that was successful. I mean, now, at the moment, obviously, the big thing that happened just before Apple Tree Yard came out was Gone Girl and the whole domestic noir, as it's called. I don't mind that so much, because I think the whole idea of a psychological thriller, it's not gender-specific. It's a much, much broader church. Whereas I think chick lit was really a derogatory term, and it was used to kind of dampen the kind of any kind of respect show writing by young women that happen to be about relationships.
So one way to avoid that is to have point of view characters who are male, and we'll come to your novel Blackwater in a little while, which has a male protagonist. I remember the writer Martin Bedford saying one of his reasons for choosing female point of view characters was because they couldn't become him. If he started out with a male, as he developed the character, they acquired more and more of his personality, views, and so on. But he knew he couldn't do that if it was a woman.
Very much so. I mean, I think it's always important, if you're creating a character, to choose at least one significant facet that's very different from yourself. I mean, with Apple, I was very aware that it was a middle-aged woman. And that's the main reason I made her a scientist. You're looking at a woman who got an E in O-level chemistry. And I think I only got that because they felt sorry for me.
Yes.
And I knew that if I made her a scientist, there would immediately be a distance between her and myself, and I would have to go out and research that job and put a lot of work into the creation of her.
And there's always this assumption, particularly if a novel is in the first person, that it is really the writer.
Yes.
I remember an instance of, I think it was Penelope Lively, who'd written a book about adultery, and it turned up at a literary festival with her husband, and she answered questions about the book until one person stood up and said, "Can we hear from your husband now?" She personally was responsible for everything that went on in the book. And that was something Green complained about in the preface to The Comedian, says exactly that. Writers know that if they write in the first person I, it's likely to be assumed that is the writer.
Yes, I mean, particularly true if, when it comes to relationships and to sex. I mean, people do generally assume that you have done everything in the books. And obviously, you can, for those of you who've read Apple Tree Yard, you will know that that's a bit of an issue. And, you know, in chapter one, we may as well get this out there now, for those of you who haven't read, there is what's colloquially known as a knee trembler in a public place.
A very public place.
And every now and then at events or festivals, there's someone who puts their hand up and says, "Louise, I just want to ask about the autobiographical element in Apple Tree Yard." And that's the point at which I always say, you want to know if I ever have really been one of the nation's top geneticists.
I've heard you say that the idea for your novel will come from, I don't want to call it a vision, but you do have a picture, a strong sort of sense of a character in a particular situation, and you go from there. So with Apple Tree Yard, it began, as I understand it, with the notion of a middle-aged, respectable woman who is in court, standing accused of a very serious crime.
Yes, that's true. Yes, vision does make it sound a bit biblical. You're right. I like it, like it comes down from heaven. I wish. That was very odd and has happened increasingly the older I've got. I don't know if it's something to do with the aging brain, but that particular picture came to me at about 10 o'clock at night when I was normally just sitting on the sofa drinking chamomile tea and falling asleep in front of news at 10. And I had a picture, it's a very strong picture, of a woman, as you say, on the witness stand at the Old Bailey, giving evidence in her own trial. And I didn't know anything about her at that stage. I knew she was middle-aged. I knew, crucially, that she was about to be exposed. I knew that she was about to be exposed in a very damaging lie that would bring her down and be her undoing. And I actually got up, this is very unusual for me, I got up from the sofa and went upstairs, and I wrote the prologue to Apple Tree Yard, about 2,500 words, just straight through. And bizarrely, and this is probably not unconnected, earlier that day my agent and I had been at a meeting with my publishers, Faber and Faber, and they wanted to do another two-book deal. My previous novel with them, Whatever You Love, had done quite well, and they were ready to invest in me, which was very nice. And I'd been talking about what books I was going to write next. I'd been giving them synopses, I'd given them some material. And the next morning, I sent the prologue to my agent. I said, "You know that meeting we had yesterday? Scrub it. This is what I want to write next." And we sent it to Faber, and they liked it. And they said, "Oh, you know, what can you tell us about the rest?" And I went, lied through my teeth, I did. I had no idea how it was going to pan out at that point.
You said you recommend this to writers, not to have it all planned out.
Very much so. Writers are either sort of planners or completely chaotic, I think. And I'm definitely in the chaotic camp, I think. To me, it would rob the process of half of its joy if I knew too clearly what was going to happen next.
And yet, that novel, Apple Tree Yard, seems very well plotted. So is it something that you have to look back at? Do you allow yourself to write and let it come out as it is coming out, and then think, well, that's got to be moved there, I've got to shift that around? Is there a process of...
Yes, there's a kind of catch with writing. Well, there's good news and bad news when it comes to my kind of method. One is that I think it's easier to produce a first draft in the sense that you're not too hard on yourself in the early stages. You're not stopping yourself and thinking, well, hang on, if I've had that scene, if I'm going to write that, then that means I've got to... you're not doing it chronologically. I mean, when I start writing in the morning, I'll read what I've written the day before, and then sometimes I'll carry on from there. But sometimes if I have an idea for a scene that's going to be three quarters of the way through the book, then I'll just write that. And so what I end up with isn't really a draft. I wouldn't dignify it with that term. It's more a version, a kind of very loose version. It's a bit like a cobweb or a sort of a dishcloth with a lot of holes. You could hold it up like that. But the catch with doing it that way is you have to be ruthless about your rewriting. Because when you come to rewrite your manuscript and fill in the holes, you have to plot and plan a bit, you have to make it all make sense, and sometimes you have to lose scenes that you really loved and that you worked very hard on in the early days, because when it actually comes to giving the whole thing, they no longer fit within the wider narrative, and you've got to be ruthless about hoiking them out.
And is that a collaborative process with an editor or something?
No, I do it on my own. I'm always on my own, yes. I always get it finished before it goes to an editor. Yeah.
Well, Apple Tree Yard, which was a success as a novel, but has reached an even wider audience with the adaptation. Were you happy with the adaptation?
I was. I was very happy with it. I think if, for those of you who've read that book, you'll understand my nervousness when I sold the rights, because you can imagine how they could have done a really bad job. And in fact, the first time I met the director, Jessica Hobbs, who's a wonderful director, she asked me a very clever question. She said, tell me, what is your greatest fear for this adaptation? And my greatest fear was that they would cast the character of Yvonne as young. I mean, in the novel, she's 52. She's a solid kind of figure. She's a ineluctably middle-aged woman with grown-up children, a suburban home, and I feared that they would cast her young and sort of sexy her up. She's not supposed to be sexy. She's supposed to be a really conventional, domesticated woman who has always done the right thing all her life, recycled her tin cans, had a good career, raised her children, and then she commits one act of folly. She does one out-of-character thing at the beginning of the book, and the whole of her life spins out of control as a result. And Jessica was great. She just said, you know, don't worry. And then later I found out that we had Emily Watson, which was, of course... And once I knew we'd got Emily Watson, I knew we were home dry, really. I was a huge fan of hers. I think when I found out she was in the picture, I probably held my breath for about 3 weeks until it was confirmed. So.
And that's an unputdownable novel in one sense. One's desperate to find out what's going to happen, but also I remember my heart beating rather too fast at some points and I had to put it down. Now, is that something you work on, or do you trust that if you've got the situation, the characters right, there will be that tension, that, if you like, that thrilling aspect to your work?
It's all about character, and I think, in a way, to bring it back to Green, I think that this is something you can see in his work, and to me the thing that makes him an ineluctably great writer is because even in the more racy novels, you believe every single character is real. And I think, to me, that's why the idea of having an image in your head of a character in a certain situation and using that as a starting point is a real advantage, because then it becomes about character development. It's who is that person? Why are they there? I once saw a talk by the crime writer Mark Billingham, who works very firmly in the mass market crime genre, and somebody asked him a question about plotting. And he said the mistake that a lot of writers make is they think if they're writing a plot-driven fiction, that what you dream up first is the plot. There's a car crash, there's a murder, there's this happens, this happens. He said, forget all that. Start with character. Start with creating a real person. Because what makes a book thrilling is not the magnitude of the drama. It's whether or not you care about what happened to the individual you're reading about. So if you don't care about a character, if they're thinly drawn, you can have them in a helicopter crash and it will not be thrilling or compulsive. But if you really care about that character and they fall down two steps, you're really anxious and you want to know what's going to happen to them. Yeah. So it's always, always character development. And, you know, when you read any, almost, well, any of the greatest of Greene's books, I think you feel that you've walked past that person in the street and they're real. And I think that's his great gift.
And I don't think he was concerned with creating easily sympathetic characters, which again is a piece of advice that can be given to creative writing students, make them sympathetic. And if that turns into make them almost perfect and victims, then that's not necessary, is it?
No. I think, you know, he was brilliant at that. And I think the idea that your characters have to be likeable is a dreadful one. Don't try and make them likeable. Try and make them engaging and interesting and real. Mm-hmm. It always annoys me in a review of a novel if somebody says, oh, I didn't really like the main character. I think, well, that tells me nothing. That's you talking about your personal preferences. It tells me nothing about the book. You know, why should characters be likeable any more than real people are likeable?
And we come to Blackwater, your eighth novel, and the one where the reviewers picked up the similarity with Graham Greene repeatedly. So this is a book for Graham Greene and John le Carré lovers. Powerful probing fiction in the tradition of Graham Greene. Repeatedly, that comparison.
You can imagine, as a Greene fan, I went a little faint with joy, actually. I think I walked around the house sort of rereading the reviews occasionally when those comments came in. Yeah.
Now, I've got some ideas about why Blackwater might have that comparison. Did you immediately see that and think, oh, yes?
I did know before it was published that it was likely comparisons would be made because of the subject matter. It's set mostly in Indonesia during the Cold War, and it's the main character, Harper, is a man who works in the field of special ops. He's what we euphemistically call a security consultant or risk analyst. I mean, the less flattering term is mercenary, but they get quite upset if you call them mercenaries, these people. And he's not a spy. He doesn't work for a national government, but he deals with the spy. He's at one point a courier between the CIA and the Indonesian military high command. And the minute you have a character like that in a country like Indonesia, particularly during the Cold War, although actually Blackwater spans 50 years in total, from Harper's birth in a Japanese internment camp in 1942 up to 1998, I knew that Greene and le Carré would be the writers who were cited. So obviously I felt I got off very lightly in that most of the comparisons were flat ones.
Well, we know that Graham Greene in his late career, when he could afford to do so, would travel extensively, and that gave him material and he could research his novels. In that way. I'm going to ask you about research, but perhaps just as a side issue. And we heard yesterday from Professor Michael Mervitt in the editing of Greene's Congo journals how he recorded that he attempted to go back into have a family life again, which he hadn't had as a daily routine of family for many years. So I'm going to ask you, how do you find, do you have a writer's routine, and how does it impact on a family life and so on? Are they compatible, or are you always worrying with yourself about whether you're shutting the door and writing?
Yes. It's a lot easier now the children are older. I mean, I did have a moment when I was writing Blackwater when I went back to Indonesia for a week. And, I mean, maybe we'll get onto the subject matter of it next, but it was very, very difficult to research the central event of the book, which was the massacres of 1965. That's very, very controversial in Indonesia, and in fact, I tried talking to people about it, and it's very, very difficult to get them to talk, for reasons that I'll go into in a minute. So when I went back, what I was looking for was actually setting an authentic detail. So the rice fields, the sound of bird song, what it's like when dawn breaks, which happens several times in the book. And I do remember sitting on the balcony of a guest house at 4 a.m. as dawn was breaking, listening to this kind of cacophony, the sort of orchestra of birds that happens with an Indonesian dawn, and thinking, if I could just stay here for 3 months, I could nail this novel. And I had a week. And that was for the simple reason that I had to get back for the kids. Not a problem, Green Hat, if I can allow myself a moment of bitterness. But I think if you're careful, if you really husband your resources, and if you do a lot of preparation for a research trip, you can do it as a hit and run. You can go in there. I had to go to Jakarta, and I had to go when my youngest child was on a school ski trip. It's a total of a week available to me, including travel, which meant actually 4 days in Jakarta. But I went with a very, very detailed list of what I needed to know. I hired a BBC fixer who looks after journalists who go there, and I gave them a list. I needed to go to the port. I needed to go to the old port as it was in 1965. I needed to go into the Kampong. I needed to go to Chinatown. These were the things I needed to do. And I did it sort of completely off my face with jet lag, and it was a really tough trip. But I think if you're ruthless as a writer, you can do that. But obviously, I envy the luxury that Green had to have extended travel. That's a wonderful thing if you can have it.
Spending the summer or the winter in the country. And clearly, in that case, you needed research because you were not going to write about a situation that you already... If you were not doing the creative writing class thing of writing about what you know. So can you explain where that novel, why it's set in Indonesia?
Yes, well,
Indonesia.
To go back a bit to the idea of where a novel starts, and I'm sure lots of you are working on novels and you'll know what I'm talking about, this idea of what is the actual germ of an idea, where does it come from, you know, what is the sort of the dinosaur DNA trapped in amber from which you build the whole of Jurassic Park, where is that? Although people tend to talk about Blackwater and Appletree Yard as though they're very different novels, in Genesis, they were actually incredibly similar. So Appletree Yard came with this image of a woman on the witness stand at the Old Bailey. And Blackwater came to me when I was a guest of the Ubud Writers and Readers Festival on Bali in 2012. And I've never been to Indonesia before, so it's a completely new experience for me. I knew nothing about the country. As you know, Indonesia doesn't really have any place in the British imagination because it wasn't colonized by Britain and there isn't a large Indonesian diaspora over here, so we're not even discovering it through music or food or other cultural elements. And the Ubud Festival, has anyone ever been to Bali, by the way? Anybody knows it? Yeah. So you know what I'm talking about. It's one of the most beautiful places on earth, really, really extraordinary. But the Ubud Festival was actually started by a woman called Janet Deneef, Australian by birth, but she's lived in Indonesia for 30 years. She's got Indonesian citizenship. And she fell in love with Bali when she went there in the 80s and with a Balinese man, married him. She's got 4 Balinese children. And she began the festival as a response to the Bali bombings, in which a lot of young Australian tourists were killed. But what's less well known is that the economy of the island completely tanked after that event, because it is a holiday island, and when the tourists stopped coming, a lot of the local families were actually starving. So she set up the festival to help encourage tourists to come back to Bali. She doesn't have a headline sponsor, but she gets sponsorship from all the local hotels, so you get put up in the most, let's just say, the sort of places writers can't normally afford. Very glamorous hotels. they fly you on a very cheap flight with a lot of stopovers. So I think I had at least two or three, came via the Middle East. I did meet an American poet there from Philadelphia. They'd flown him via Moscow. And he was so tired he could hardly speak. So I was staying in the most beautiful hotel, 40 minutes drive out of Ubud, halfway up a valley above the Ayong River. My room was my own polished wooden bungalow with, wait for it, a butler. I had a butler for the first and last time in my life. And I didn't sleep a wink, awake every single night. And at home in London, I kept awake by car alarms and drunks in the street. But here, I was being kept awake by the cicadas, the monkeys on the roof, the geckos, all the insects, the noises of a Southeast Asian night. And an image came to me of a man lying awake in a hut in rural Indonesia. And I didn't know who he was or why he was there, but I knew that he believed that men with machetes were going to come and kill him. And he's lying awake and he's listening to the sounds on his roof and he's waiting for them to turn into rain because he knows that the men will wait for monsoon rain on the roof to cover their sounds as they approach his wooden hut. So when he hears rain, he thinks that will be the moment when they will come. And the next day I wrote that scene, still didn't know, had no idea who he was. And then I had to work out who that man was and why he was there.
You use a number of epigraphs. The one that's quite chilling, and I quoted this the day after the Manchester bombing, when I went past St. Anne's Square where all the flowers were. I was teaching very close to that. And you've quoted a Dr. Claiborne Carson, who in response to the question, the biggest threat to world peace, he comments, the biggest threat to world peace, young men between the ages of 18 and 25, especially if they are unemployed, unmarried, and don't own property.
Yeah. I mean, that had a big influence on me, that quote. And Harper turns out to be, he's an older man as the novel begins, but then you go back to his youth, to his early 20s, and he is one of those young men, a disenfranchised young man, and he ends up doing national service in the Netherlands, Dutch national service, and then he becomes a mercenary. I think if for any of you who are thinking of starting a novel with an opening scene with a character, obviously the easy way to development then is what I had to do with Harper, as he's called in the book, is to just do some dates. You know, how old is your character in that opening scene and when were they born? And I decided straight away that the novel was going to open in 1998, which is the year the military regime of Major General Suharto fell. And I thought, right, if Harper's in his 50s, let's trace that back. That has him born in 1942, which is when Indonesia was occupied by the Japanese. So Harper is born in a Japanese internment camp. He's mixed race. He's the son of a white Dutch mother and an Indonesian father who is killed by the Japanese because he's fighting in the Dutch colonial army. And at the end of the war, he and his mother, Harper's only three at this stage, go back to the Netherlands as displaced persons. And when I did a bit of research into that, I found out that what happened was that the widows of the Indonesian officers didn't get the Dutch army pensions because they were brown, basically. They didn't get the pensions. So she then emigrates to the United States and he grows up in California. She marries a black GI. You can see I didn't make my life easy with this book, did I? But she marries a black GI whose father is a leading lawyer in the civil rights movement, and Harper spends some of his formative years in California. But when they come back to the Netherlands, that's when he does his national service and ends up becoming effectively a mercenary and is sent into Indonesia for the events of 1965. I don't know how many of you know about this, but if you think about what we all know about Vietnam during the Cold War, I mean, this is another reason why the comparisons with Graham Greene and Le Carré came up, because in many ways it's a Cold War novel. Indonesia, and independent Indonesia, began drifting leftward under its first leader, Sukarno. The CIA actually took a pop at Sukarno a couple of times in the 1950s without success. At that time, the PKI, which was in the Indonesian Communist Party, was the largest communist party outside China or the Soviet Union. It had 3 million members. And the American CIA and Britain were desperate that Southeast Asia should not become the new communist bloc. And in 1965, on the night of 30th of September, there was a coup, allegedly by the PKI, attempting to unseat Sukarno. It was defeated with suspicious rapidity. Within 5 days, the coup leaders had all been arrested, and Major General Suharto, the military dictator, moved into power. And that was the cue for a massacre, a huge massacre of communists or suspected communists, which ranks, it is one of the great tragedies of the second half of the 20th century. I mean, it ranks alongside the massacres in Cambodia or Rwanda. It's completely unheard of here. And Harper, as a young man, ends up having a key role as a courier in the massacres in Jakarta. So when the novel opens, it's 32 years later, he's come back to Indonesia for reasons which are gradually revealed, and that is when the ghosts of his past come to get him. And you can see then why people thought of him as a kind of Greenian hero, because he's a man with a very troubled past and a lot of personal guilt. And it is very much about personal morality. When he imagines young men climbing the hillside to kill him in the middle of the night, what he's really imagining is the ghosts of his younger self. And it's the ghosts of his past that are going to come and get him.
At one point, thinking back, as you say, the novel begins with him as an older man. He thinks back on his younger self, and he thinks of himself as somebody who returned from Indonesia broken. And he is, in many ways, a green character. Morally complex.
Very morally complex, and also a man, yes, a man struggling with his own morality. And it won't surprise you to learn, as we're in green territory here, that a lot of that comes out in his relationship with a woman. The day after this revelation, he goes into Ubud and he meets a woman in a bar, Rita, who turns out to have her own complexities. And he starts telling her the story of his life and what happened to him 30 years before. And that is, in a way, his undoing, because it's his growing love for Rita that kind of weakens him. And then he has a moral dilemma, because if he stays with Rita, if he's right about a killing squad coming to get him, then obviously he's endangering her. But if he leaves, he may be giving up his only chance for love and redemption. And the idea was also that Harper is a metaphor for Indonesia itself. I mean, I think what you see in a lot of green characters is they represent a lot more than themselves. They represent a kind of a geopolitical situation. And I suppose what I was aiming for with Harper is, you know, can this man find love and redemption unless he's honest with Rita about what he's done in his past, the terrible things that he's done? Can a country like Indonesia find stability and have a kind of a civil society if it doesn't have some kind of truth and reconciliation process, which sadly Indonesia has never done.
So how is the novel received in Indonesia itself?
Well, I'm sort of unofficially banned in Indonesia. The massacres are still incredibly controversial. There's a filmmaker called Joshua Oppenheimer from Texas, who's made a couple of films about it. He can't go back. He's had too many death threats. I haven't had death threats, although I was a bit nervous about being arrested. I went back last October for the Ubud Festival, which was very nice because it was 4 years since I'd got the idea for the book. It was coming full circle. The year before, 2015, had been the 50th anniversary of the massacres, and I'd been originally due to go that year. But the authorities nearly closed the festival down. There were several events that were commemorating 65, and the authorities, Janet had a phone call basically saying, if you don't shut down the 65 events, we'll withdraw the license for the whole festival. And that year was apparently very tense. So when I went in 2016, what Janet said to me is, we just have to be a bit careful, because they did want me to get through immigration at the airport. They didn't want me deported at the airport. And so basically, we just have to say nothing about the subject matter of Blackwater online or in the brochure. And she said, you can speak freely at the events because the authorities won't come to the events, but they will read the brochure and they will. So it just said Louise Doughty's new novel, Blackwater, and it talked about Apple Tree Yard. I was slightly nervous getting there. But Janet was very keen that I and the other writers talking about 65, that we should speak freely and that that should be a kind of antidote to what had happened the previous year when the events had been banned. And so we did. I had very open discussions. I mean, I was on stage with Indonesian writers who, of course, you know, they, it's their country they're talking about, and they are putting themselves at risk to a certain extent. And it was only afterwards I realised that a lot of people kept coming up to me and saying, we can't find your books. The bookseller hasn't got them. And they, there's a very good local bookseller, had a very wide stock, nothing of mine. And when I got back to the UK, I did a bit of investigation, and the bookseller did have my books. He was too scared to sell them. He'd had a phone call suggesting it might not be good for the health of his business if he sold my books. So, and booksellers in Jakarta won't take them. They might get bricks through the window from the local militias if they do. So,
this sounds like your finest hour, if I may say so, rather like Green and the response in Haiti to the comedians. You know, to have the courage to raise this subject, and thank you for myself and some of my students. We read Blackwater, and we all felt we knew a great deal more about Indonesia than we had done previously, and we were rather ashamed of ourselves. However, we missed these events. Really?
Well, me too. I mean, I couldn't believe, really, that the events that I cover in the book are so little known over here. It's such a colossal event in the second half of the 20th century in terms of global history. Green would have loved it. Green would have been right out there.
You write at one stage in Blackwater about John Harper. He's at an airport, and he rather likes these sort of places when he's in between. And you write, the power of transience. In motion, you could be whoever you wanted to be. And I thought that could apply to many of Green's characters, and indeed perhaps to Green himself.
I think so very much. I mean, you know, you only have to have a passing acquaintance with his biography. That, you know, all that travelling, it's not just about research. If it's just about research, you can do a quick run. But, you know, when you travel as extensively as Green did, you're not just going to something. You are also on the run. And you're on the run from the self that you are when you're in your normal, inverted commas, or domestic situation. And I think, yeah, that's no coincidence that he wrote the books he did and that he led the life he did as well.
Well, I do want to give time for questions, because I know there have been questions. But I must ask you, Louise, thank you for all those answers, but also what are you working on now? Has the next idea come to you?
It has, and again, it's slightly different. I mean, all my books tend to be very different, which is not nice for my publisher, really. I mean, publishers really do prefer it if you can write the same book again and again. And the next one, I think, is a ghost story. And it's going to sound slightly odd, but it's set largely on Peterborough Railway Station. So last novel, I went to the rice fields of Bali. This time I'm spending more time than I want on the station in the East Midlands, where the wind will blow. So, yeah, it's something different. But I think there's always an element of mystery in my books, in the widest sense of the word. I hope that there are always a lot of questions that the readers want answered. And whatever form they take, whatever geography they take place in, I think that's the big challenge of writing. Can you have a reader going, what the heck is going on here? I really need to know.
We really look forward to that. Has it got a title so we can look out for it?
At the moment it's called Platform 7.
Platform 7.
I don't know. Do we think is that a flyer? I know. Is that... You can tell me afterwards if you think it's a rubbish idea. There's plenty of time to change it. Early stages.
So, questions to Louise. Eve, would you like to ask your question?
Two of your books that made a big impression on me was your two books about your Romani background and history, And I just wondered if you were to write anything more on that. Do you think either of them could ever be made into television or a film? I'd just like to hear your comments about it.
Oh, thank you. I'd love it if they would be adapted. I don't think it's likely. I mean, there are two books I wrote about my own ancestry. The first of them, novel number 4, Fires in the Dark, is set during the Second World War, and it's about the killing of the Czech Roma under the Nazi regime. And it starts in 1927, and then it goes through the rise of Nazism, the Great Depression, the events of the Second World War. And it culminates with the Prague Uprising of May 1945. In many ways, that book, I think, was the one that prepared me to write Blackwater. Because although it's a historical novel, I think that's probably where I moved into what you might call Greenian territory, in the sense of writing about global political events, writing about people being killed on the most basic level. It's an incredibly hard thing to do. And I think that was also my longest novel. It's about 600 pages in paperback. It's about 170,000 words. It was the first time I'd written a historical book, so it was the first book I'd written that was really heavily researched and also involved travel to the Czech Republic. The second book, Yativ mentioned, Stone Cradle, is about my own family ancestry, which is English Romanichals in the end of the 19th, early 20th century. And that, I think, was me really exploring, in particular, the ancestry on my father's side and where my father came from. I mean, my father left school at 13 with no qualifications at all, was very, very keen for all of his children to be sort of educated, middle-class children, succeeded very well. But his grandfather grew up in a workhouse in Cambridgeshire where he went by the title of Pauper 57. And I did have a real moment after the success of Apple Tree Yard. I got the letter inviting me to correct my entry for Who's Who. And I had a real moment thinking about my father, who sadly had died a couple of years before, thinking, Dad, you know, we went from Pauper 57 to Who's Who in a couple of generations. And the linchpin of that change was my father and his determination to be educated. So I think that Stone Cradle in particular is exploring something very personal to me. Whether or not I'll go back to it, I don't honestly know. I have to say that there was a lot of commercial resistance to books about Roma and gypsies and travellers. Nobody would buy them. They got very good reviews, absolute. Died a death at the box office. So whether or not it's possible for me to write more in a way that obviously Faber want me to carry on writing the sort of books that have sold, and that's a huge pressure. So we'll see. It's territory I'd like to return to. But thank you for mentioning those, because people don't normally. That's my lesser known work.
Thank you very much both for a very interesting discussion. I'd like to ask Louise, you said that some of your characters come to you in prototypical form. You have a vision of someone and you scribble down something about them, and then you spend obviously some time elaborating the story and filling in the details of the character. So you have created them. What's your relationship with them after the book has been written and published? Do you continue to have a relationship with them, or do you leave them behind?
Well, I probably would leave them behind if I could. I'm a bit like Green, you know, once the work's done and published, that's it, you know. But obviously nowadays, in particular, this isn't something Graham Greene had to do so much, is there's an enormous procedure of book promotion now, rounds of festivals. I mean, I really have spent most of this year going to literary festivals up and down the country, mostly for the paperback of Blackwater, which came out earlier this year, but also because the TV tie-in edition of Apple Tree Yard came out in January. So in a way, it's been a bit like publishing two books this year, because there's been a lot of interest in that. And there is a sense that it can be quite disconcerting. You're sitting on a stage and you're answering questions about a book, particularly if you're well into the next book. Sometimes I have trouble remembering the characters' names. And particularly foreign editions. I was in Italy last year promoting the Italian edition of Whatever You Love, which is a book I wrote quite a long time ago now, and I really did have to, you know, the Italian interviewer was saying, Louise, it strikes me about Laura, your main character. I was thinking, Laura. Oh, Laura, yes, that's right. I think that nowadays there is an expectation that you have to keep the books going. You have to be out there promoting, you have to be on social media. You're not allowed to leave your characters behind in the same way. And that means, I think, you develop a slightly ambivalent relationship with them.
Would somebody get published now if they didn't want to do that sort of thing? I'm wondering how Green would fare in that respect. There seemed to me to be a shyness about him. Occasionally, when I've given a talk about Green, people have asked, would you like to have met him? And I've tended to answer, well, if I'd rushed up and gushed about his work, I know he would have been horrified and backed away very quickly.
That's a very interesting question. How would someone like Green fare at this kind of process? He probably would have hated it, but also maybe partly loved it a bit as well, because I think that obviously most writers, you know, we spend most of our lives in a room on our own making up stories, which is arguably not a normal way to earn a living. And then you come out at an event and you're answering questions, and the analogy I use is it's a bit like a badger most of the time. You're sort of burrowing in the dark, and then somebody grabs you by your hind legs, hauls you out of the burrow, puts you in a cocktail dress and throws you on a table surrounded by people and says, now tap dance. And I think that's what it feels like for a lot of writers, and I suspect Green would have been one of those.
You had the taxi driver.
Oh yes, that was that's my story that I was telling kind of over lunch. Often you get in cabs, black cabs in London, and you know you're driving home and the cabbie will be very chatty, and quite often, I don't know why this should be asked so often of women passengers, but it seems to be, is what do you do for a living then, darling? You know, they like to ask that in a chatting way. What have you been doing? What are you up to then? And sometimes I say, well, guess. Which is a bit unfair because I know what he does for a living, obviously. And as I live in North London, they always guess the media straight away, and it's just a question of narrowing it down. And with this particular cabbie, eventually I confessed that I was a writer. And he said, I had another writer in the back of my cab once, he said. And I said to him, I said, how do you write a book then? And he said, write about what you know. He said, you did that, love. He said, yeah, write about I know. I thought, I've always wanted to write a book. He said, he was such a nice bloke. He said, he was a Mr. Brown. He said, anyway, and he said, write about what you know. He said, hey, well, tall, thin fella, lovely gent, lovely manners. Drove him up to Hansard. No, hang on a minute. It wasn't Brown. It was another colour. Moment. Graham Greene? That was the fella, Graham Greene. Write about what you know. That's the nearest I got to Graham Greene.
Any more questions?
A set number of words. What's your way of working?
Oh, I know, the 500 words a day, his penance has gone. I envy him that. I'm much more chaotic in the sense that for the past 20 years, my writing life's revolved around childcare. And that means that sometimes, you know, I've had 6 hours to write, sometimes I've had all day, sometimes I've had to stop at 10 to take a kid to a dental appointment. So I've never been able to have that kind of daily quota. I also find that rather than do something like 500 words every day, 5 days a week, I will tend to have 1 or 2 days where I do 2,000 or 3,000 words. And then after that, I feel a bit spent. I mean, the day after 2,000 or 3,000 words, I don't really, really want to write anything. I work in cafes a lot. And that, again, is to do with the domestic situation. Even though the children are older now and the house is empty, if I'm at home, if I go to put the kettle on, I start thinking, why don't I just unload the dishwasher now or take the chicken out of the freezer? Again, not problems that Green had. And then I've got my domestic head on and not my work head. So I will take a laptop and I'll go to a cafe and I will have several cappuccinos in a row and do a splurge. But I do really envy, it's something about that whole particular generation of writers, you know, Green and Hemingway and Orwell, and this idea that I think they did have, that you could be, if you like, a jobbing writer, you could treat it like a job. And I think that's less and less true now with social media, with promotion. Lots of writers, of course, nowadays, instead of writing book reviews or journalism, as Green did, they'll teach in universities. And I think being a part-time lecturer has replaced the sort of the writing, the jobbing writer jobs that people of Green's generation could do. I mean, in Green's heyday, you could actually earn a living as a book reviewer. There were professional book reviewers who did one a week, and that was how they raise their families and pay the rent, and that's certainly not possible now. And I think it's why, in many ways, I love that whole group of writers, and I love that whole era of literature, and that whole mid-20th century idea, because it was the era of the professional jobbing writer and the 500 words a day. So I feel slightly nostalgic for it. And
what was your relationship with your editor? And I don't know much about it, but probably somebody... Green's long writing career of 60-odd years, I wonder what his relationship with editors... Can you imagine an editor when he was 80? I wonder what his comments on his work would be, or the publisher suggesting to Mr. Green what could be the topic of your... I wanted a cheap laugh, by the way. Is there a novel in Brexit anywhere?
Of course, people are claiming that the Brexit novels are happening. They're saying the Ali Smith that's on the Man Booker shortlist, they're saying that's the Brexit novel. There's a novelist called Amanda Craig, published a novel earlier this year called The Lie of the Land, which is about a couple moving out to from London down to Devon. That's supposedly a Brexit novel. Yes, I mean, I would love to know what Green would make if of our current political climate if he was writing political fiction now. As to the idea of him being edited, it's quite hard to imagine, isn't it? I've had quite a high turnover of editors. I seem to see them off. They all seem to get poached by other publishing houses, or maybe they leave. Maybe it's something to do with me. Of course, the big difference between our literary culture and Green's is that nowadays an author's primary relationship is no longer with their editor. Because what's happened in publishing is that the publishing has, if you like, sort of conglomerated. You know, there are seven or so big houses. You know, Random House and Penguin have merged. There aren't the small imprints. It's all completely separate businesses that there were in Green's day. And what that means is that they're big corporate businesses. They have shareholders who might invest in Penguin Random House and also be investing in the Royal Bank of Scotland or Esso, you know, and there is a much more of a sense of having to get commercial returns. And what that has meant is the rise of the power of the people in sales and marketing. And what editors have to do now is they have to go into an acquisition meeting when they want to buy a book and sit round the table with the marketing people and pitch the book to the marketing people. And the marketing, and before they will make you an offer, they have to defend the book, say why they want to publish it, and have to come up with a sales projection. This is before they will even make the offer to the author. And the advance that you are offered is based on that sales projection. What that means is that, I mean, I'm very lucky to be with Faber and Faber because it's an editorially led publishing house, and although it's got 70 staff now, it is still independent. And that's, in these days, is quite unusual. And it has a large editorial department, and certainly my primary relationship is with my editor. But for most publishers now, the editors have much less power, and it's much more about the marketing people. And with, you know, Graham Greene, they would have looked at the sales of the novel before, and they would have said, oh, well, you know, that one didn't do so well. I think we're going to have to offer Mr. Green a bit less this time, because that one only sold 5,000 copies. The one before sold 10,000. It's a downward trajectory. You can't offer Mr. Green more than 2,500 for this, you know. So it's sobering. And it's very, very different from...
And is there a relationship to television and films and blah, blah, blah?
Well, obviously, I mean, this is, you know, one of the things that sustained Green's career, and it certainly sustains writers these days. I mean, adaptations make a huge difference. The adaptation of Appletree Yard puts the book back up in the bestseller list. It really transformed the fate of the book and my career. I mean, they are one of the things that sort of rescue writers from obscurity.
Well, we hope you never go into obscurity, Louise. We hope you come back to the festival, and we thank you for your enthusiasm for Green, which of course we share, and many of us here already know your work and are looking forward to the next novel. Some of you will not yet have read Blackwater or Apple Tree Yard. There are some copies at the back. I hope you're going to be happy to sign them.
Yes,
thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.